this is the prayer of the day appointed for this coming Sunday. It's interesting how the Bible study passages are fitting in with the Sunday texts. So this is the prayer you'll hear on Sunday also. Let us pray. O God, our defender, storms rage about us and cause us to be afraid. Rescue your people from despair. Deliver your sons and daughters from fear, and preserve us all from unbelief. Through your Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Today we're going to talk about all those issues: storms, fear, unbelief, rescue, etc. in the stilling of the storm passage in Luke 8. If you want to turn to that, Luke 8, 22 and following. This follows pretty closely on what we did yesterday, where we looked at the two miracles at the beginning of chapter 7, and the whole question there that's posed is, who is Jesus? Who is this? And in that chapter, I think Luke is making a definite attempt to connect him with Elijah. We talk about that a lot, to show that he is a great prophet. That's the acclamation that people said. They glorified God, saying, a great prophet has arisen among us. That's after a healing that's very similar to Elijah's healing of the widow's son in the book of 1 Kings. Then the Pharisee too, when Jesus is at table with him, is raising the question at the end of chapter 7 of, who is this? Is this man a prophet or not? And the Pharisee decides he must not be, because he allows this woman to wash his feet. And I think we, the readers, are supposed to think he is a great prophet. So the question is already very much alive in the readers' minds of, who is Jesus that does these things? And now it's going to be posed directly on the lips of the disciples, which usually when you read in the Gospels disciples, that means it's supposed to be, we're supposed to take that as us, the church. So you can see what you think there. We also saw in yesterday's second or first healing story, the whole issue of faith was raised, in that the centurion, who was not a Jew, had such faith in Jesus that he even says to him, I'm not worthy to have you come to my house, but just say a word and I know that my slave will be healed. And then Jesus marvels and says, not even in Israel have I found such faith. So we talked yesterday about the role of faith in the whole issue of miracles, healing. And today I want to really have us take up that issue as we struggle with the story of the stilling of the storm. And I guess to even get to sort of the big questions, like, do miracles enhance your faith? Or are miracles an obstacle to faith because they're so hard to believe and they seem to defy science or reason? Or how do miracles fit into faith for you today? You know, I think there's a lot of different ways that we can answer that depending on what our life experiences have been, but I'd really like to hear from some of you about how you feel about these stories and what they do for your faith. So keep those kinds of big questions in mind as we look at the text. Then I want to just make some comments about sort of Old Testament antecedents to this and ways that Luke might be shaping this story around some Old Testament passages as well, and then open it up to really take some time to discuss how we see miracles in our faith life and how the New Testament can help us or whatever. So would somebody be willing to read this story? Let's see if I need to set any more context. Well, Jesus has just been teaching here in chapter 8, teaching the disciples. I think we can just jump right in. Luke is pretty much following the order in Mark here, except that he's just added in this little thing about his mother and his brothers and his sisters right before here. But otherwise, it pretty much follows the order of the same passages in Mark, and with some important changes, though. We'll look at those. Somebody want to read verses 22 to 25?
One day, he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, let us go across to the other side of the lake. So they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a storm of wind came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. And they went and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we are perishing. And he awoke and rebuked the wind, and the raging waves, and they ceased, and there was a calm. He said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even the wind and the water, and they obey him?"
Okay, just a couple of comments. This is a water story, clearly. You can, for us who are from the Midwest, it's hard to imagine how water could be so terrifying, although I guess in Minnesota we have like Mille Lacs Lake and Lake Superior and stuff, and boats have certainly gone down. But for people who lived along the Mediterranean, as the Greco-Roman world was, you know, extended from, say, Italy, across Greece, Turkey, Syria, Palestine, dying down that way, and over to Egypt, water was the main way that, that people got anywhere. And there was a whole tradition in the Old Testament, as well as in other Greco-Roman religions at the time of Jesus, that water was a terrifying thing. The sea was very important in their lives, yet it could be so unpredictable. And there's a lot of miracle stories of salvation from water. In the Old Testament, of course, the most famous and earliest would be the Red Sea crossing. That's a place where God used water to save and also to destroy. The Israelites got across, but the Egyptians didn't. So that water is something that God commands and controls, and that God can use it to do both scary and wonderful things. And then what's another Old Testament story that probably has the most direct kind of storm link with this? Somebody who got caught in a big storm. Yeah, Jonah certainly is behind this text. The whole story there of the great storm that came up. And the early Christians that read these stories and heard these stories about Jesus would definitely have been familiar with the Old Testament, would have known that Jonah story and kind of had that in their minds as they read this. So water, all through the scriptures, is used as a saving and a mighty element. That's the case also. There are some interesting parallels with other religions around the same time as Jesus. It seemed that a sort of stock story almost was a shipwreck salvation story that we find with Paul in the book of Acts, for example, where he's in this terrible shipwreck. But it also could be found in with the god Serapis from Egypt. There's a famous shipwreck story with him. Asclepius also saved people from shipwrecks. It seemed that that was a very common thing for gods to do in the ancient world, was to address themselves to issues of storms, winds, distress on the sea, shipwrecks, that kind of thing. And so in a sense, this story is similar to some of those, although there are important differences also. But to be God, you would have to be lord of the wind and the waves. That was a really important thing. Political leaders also claimed lordship over the wind and the waves. There's a really interesting passage in 2 Maccabees, one of the apocryphal books. We don't have it in the Protestant scriptures, but it is in the Roman Catholic scriptures, where Antiochus Epiphanes, remember this really bad, well, he wasn't the emperor, this really bad ruler, the one that persecuted the Jewish people, he claims to be lord of the wind and the waves. And Caligula also made those kinds of claims, that he as emperor was God, he was one of the divinized emperors, and that he ruled the wind and the waves. So that's a really important question, is who's in charge of the wind and the waves, the weather? Let's just look at a couple psalms where I think we see this really clearly, that God is the one who controls the water and the seas and the winds. This is a very common theme in the psalmist, often tied to the Red Sea crossing, but then sort of much more generalized than that, where God, who led the people miraculously through the Red Sea, now is definitely the one who controls wind and waves and all of that. Psalm 107, let's look at verses 28 to 30 on that. I'm going to shut this window. All right.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Does that help at all? That'll probably keep it warm.
So does somebody want to read? Psalm 107 is a wonderful psalm, sort of recalling, as so many of the psalms do, God's great deeds. Kind of, and you start with the Exodus and the Red Sea, then the wilderness wanderings here, what God did to the people. They cried to God. God delivered them. Well, actually, let's read the whole passage here, because it's interesting, God's relationship with the sea here, the way God sometimes commands storms and stills storms here. Everything is in God's control. Does somebody want to start with 23 and read through 32 here?
Some went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep. For he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven, they went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in their evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad because they had quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wonderful works to the sons of men. Let them extol him in the congregation of the people, and praise him in the assembly of the elders.
Okay, and then another passage that I thought we could turn to on a little different line, but also in the Psalms, is Psalm 44. This would be an example of people crying out to God in their distress, as the disciples cried to Jesus, "Save, Lord, for we are perishing," you know, when Jesus is asleep in the stern of the boat. And this is a very common theme also in the Psalms, where you cry out to God, asking for a little action here on the part of whatever troubles you. And here isn't the weather, but it's I think, that same kind of thing, where we can turn to God and ask for something to happen when God is seemingly asleep. Does somebody want to read Psalm 44, verses 23 to 26?
Rouse thyself, why sleepest thou, O Lord? Awake, do not cast us off forever. Why dost thou hide thy face? Why dost thou forget our affliction and oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust, our body cleaves to the ground. Rise up, come to our help. Deliver us for the sake of thy steadfast love.
And then finally, I was just thinking, that reminded me of, is it Psalm 122 or 121, where it says, the one who watches over Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. I mean, there is this whole question already in the Psalms of, does God ever fall asleep? Does God need to be woken up? Which we obviously find here in Psalm 44. Why are you sleeping, O God? That whole theme here. So you can see, anyway, I don't think we need to look at any more, but and the Psalms are full of this water stuff. In Psalm 107, you saw it was God who both brought the storm and then stilled the storm. And that same word is used, that you stilled the storm and brought us to safe haven. So there's very much that idea that God is doing that. Okay, if we look back at the Luke passage, if you want to turn back to Luke 7 here, or Luke 8, sorry. And just let's go through the passage. One important thing, I think, that picks up on what we saw yesterday also with the Elijah miracle, with the little, the widow's son who had died, Elijah stretched himself on him three times, remember, and then prayed to God, "Oh Lord, raise this child." Whereas Jesus raises the widow's son not by praying to God, but saying directly to him, "I tell you, get up." So there, Jesus was taking on himself the role of God, right? That's the big difference between Jesus and Elijah, is that Elijah performed a resurrection by praying to God, whereas Jesus did it himself. And here too, I think we see that same thing going on in this story, that whereas Jonah prayed to God for help in the storm, Jesus takes on himself that mighty, majestic role of God by saying directly to the waves, not, "Oh Lord, keep these waves still," but, "I command you," rebuking them and telling them to be silent. It's much more clear in the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus sort of performs an exorcism on the waves. Maybe now that I had you look at Luke, why don't you hold your finger in Luke and let's look at the Mark story. And you can see that in Mark 4, where Jesus is the one who has the power to command the wind and the waves to be still, and he does it. Mark 4, 39. "And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm." Those are the same words that he used in the exorcism at the beginning of the gospel, "Peace, be still." Where it's almost here then that the wind and the waves take on that same evil role as a demon would have, that the demon needs to be cast out of the wind and the waves so that there's calm to come. And Jesus does that himself. He doesn't pray to God. He directly commands the wind and the waves. So then that leads to the disciples' question here, who is this then that he commands even wind and water and they obey him? Back in Luke, that's the way it's cast here. And obviously a person who knows the Old Testament would know who it is that commands the wind and the waves. It's God. And so, the response certainly is that this man must be God, or like God, or, that he's an amazing figure, that he can command the wind and the seas and still the storm, as the psalmist says that God does. Well, let's get to some of those sort of big questions. Jump right in on how we're supposed to then see this in our faith. Jesus, you can't tell in Luke whether he's angry at the disciples or not. In Matthew, it's very clear. He calls them people of little faith. "Oh, ye of little faith." But here it's sort of more an open-ended question. Verse 25, Jesus says to the disciples, "Where is your faith?" But still, I think there's the implication that their faith somehow has failed them here, or what's going on? Are they people of little faith or what? And I think that's sort of what I want to try to get at today as we struggle with our faith. What do miracles mean? It's puzzling here, because there's a sense in which I think, at least for me, that the disciples did have faith, and that's why they woke Jesus up, because they thought he could do something, right? If they had really thought that he was powerless to do anything, they probably would have just let him sleep and go down with the waves. But so, that's sort of the puzzling thing, is that they woke him up in order that he would do something. And yet then he says, "Well, where is your faith?" So that's a question right there. And I think that's really a tough thing with a lot of people with miracles, is that we so quickly, at least Paul Bowe was sharing in the first session, Paul Bowe, our interim director, he has four children, two of whom died in infancy, one of whom is pretty severely handicapped, and the fourth of whom had polio. And he talked about how they prayed and prayed for healing for these children, for a miracle, and it didn't happen. And that sort of his immediate response is, the possible challenge that miracles can be to faith, when we sort of say to people, "Well, where is your faith that this didn't happen for you?" Those kinds of questions I think are very prominent in people's lives who really struggle with issues of healing and terminal illness, and when miracles don't seem to happen. So Jesus here is raising the faith question, and I think we can do that too. And just share honestly. And there's a whole poll. For some people, miracles really strengthen their faith. It's been a miracle that has brought you to faith. It's looking at the scriptures and seeing Jesus' wonderful miracles that makes you realize he is God and Lord. And that's certainly what the New Testament writers want us to see. And on the other end, there are people for whom miracles are truly an obstacle to faith, because they contradict science, they contradict reason. they don't happen, therefore it must mean there's no God if they're supposed to happen, and all those kinds of things. And maybe most of us fall somewhere in between of just kind of, you know, wondering. So how about you? Where are you on this?
Uh-huh. Well, in his case, obviously, it didn't keep him from having faith, which I think is probably very important, that when you pray for a mm-hmm. special healing or a special miracle, but if your prayers aren't answered the way you think they should be, we really aren't aware of reasoning behind all of this, why that sort of thing happens. But you know, I think the important thing is that it didn't drive him away, because it, you know, some people can have so many problems that I think either brings you closer to God or farther away.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're right. That is a wonderful thing. And we asked him directly, well, how, you know, yeah. how did you still stay close to God and pray, and yet nothing seemed to happen? And he, you know, said, well, it wasn't that nothing happened. It's just that what didn't, you know, it didn't happen the way that we asked. But yeah.
See, that's the, you know, when we set our expectations in prayer to be as we want it to be rather than what the good Lord would have for us, because, you know, we can be answered yes, no, or maybe, or wait, you know, in our prayer expectations. Sometimes our goals are set which are not the will of God, and that shouldn't shatter our faith. It should make us understand that sometimes what we're asking for isn't in the will of God at all, you know. And that's something that we have to take an honest good look at in prayer.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There have been twice in my life times when I have felt the miraculous closeness of God in two events in my life. And I live in appreciation for those two times, but it also makes me hunger to have that happen again. And it may never happen again. And sometimes I get very impatient, and when troubles come, especially in terms of our children and their health, and you want that to happen again, and it doesn't happen again, then you wonder, well, what's changed? What's happened?
Is he asleep?
Why not again?
In the boat.
So, I mean, we live with great gratitude for what has happened. But when you experience that, it also leaves you with a great hunger for it to happen again. But by nature of a miracle, something that doesn't happen with great regularity, of course, you know, you don't expect it to. But you're hungry for it.
Our time frame and God's is sometimes quite different. I was married for 32 years to a man whom I prayed daily for strength in his faith. I was born a preacher's kid, so I was born into it, as you can, you know, understand. And but the man I married didn't have the kind of faith I had, and constantly that was one of my greatest desires. After termination of that 32-year marriage, I was 5 years alone, and I kept thinking, you know, this was an expectation I had that was not fulfilled. But in pursuing a volunteer grief ministry with the hospice movement, I became acquainted with a man who had a faith early in his life, but during a period of his life didn't exercise that faith as most of us continue to try to grow day by day and day. And at that point, I was aware that here was a gentleman whose faith could be rekindled, and I had that opportunity to give that to this gentleman. And our marriage of 35 months was like heaven on earth because of the growth that I saw in this. And I kept being reinforced with the idea that you prayed all those years for a man in the faith, and now you have one. You know, take and make the most of every day, which we did. And unfortunately, his life was only 35 months in marriage with me. because of his heart condition. But they were the best 35 months of my life, in all due respects. And I have that memory of the strengthening of my faith, as well as showing this man what a raw, real strong faith was, because he was indeed ready when his life ended, because of what he had grown in those last months of our lives together. That was like a miracle.
Heather, did you?
One time our pastor talked about the temptations of Christ in terms of miracles, and sort of, you know, the fallacies of just depending upon miracles. And so I think there are indeed dangers with the miracles. When you keep, whether you are in a position of faith or the faithless, the miracles can sort of get saturated. You keep wanting more and more. And then somehow the object of control, like you ought to be able to control, if you get enough faith, then you can control and the miracle will happen because of your faith. You're still putting the control in yourself rather than the control in God. And the other thing, miracles, if the real miracle is a change within yourself, if you're just an observer looking at some miracle, the wonder of it at the moment, you have a momentary wonder, but then as time goes on, this momentary wonder tends to fade off and not be lasting, which I think was the essence of if Jesus had done this one big spectacular leap to be saved by the angel, you know, what sort of lasting value would that have had in the world?
There's a really interesting, I think the temptation stories point us that way, and a lot of the ways that gospel writers cast the miracles, that it's not just the sort of miraculous physical thing that we're caused to see. In the Gospel of John, the story of the feeding of the, is it 5,000 in John? I can't remember anyway, would be a really good example of that, where, you know, everybody saw the miracle that Jesus is multiplying the loaves, and yet Jesus sort of criticizes those who then just follow him because he can multiply loaves. It's obviously something more that John wants us to see in Jesus when he does that. It's not enough to just believe in him as the one who can give us all the bread we want, you know, so that's the danger, is that you see it just sort of the physical dimension of the miracle. And certainly with this story, there's all kinds of sort of levels you can read it at, too, and that's what, I don't know if that invitation is there. I mean, there's, the words are sort of, save, Lord, for we are perishing. Now, save, you know, is used in the very physical sense of here, get us out of the storm, get us to shore before we die. Or, you know, salvation is much more than that in the scriptures, too. And perishing is a real loaded term, too. That's the same one here. They're perishing in the storm, but that's also the word that would be used in, you know, perishing in our sinfulness and all of that. So quickly, the church tended to allegorize stories like this and say, the church is a boat, and, you know, we're all sort of at sea in the world of storms, you know, and tossed about. And maybe that's a really important way to see this, sort of the more general level. And Jesus is seemingly asleep because he hasn't come back yet, and he promised that he would. But yet we're supposed to have faith even in all the storms of life. You know, we even have hymns that sing about the storms of life, don't we? And we don't mean the storms on Mille Lacs Lake or Lake Superior or whatever. We mean the storms of life that are more than that. So, you know, there are possibilities of reading this at all kinds of different levels. And, you know, maybe that doesn't diminish the physical miracle here, but simply enhance it. Maybe that's a good way for people who read it, who can't believe in the physical. I don't know. And yet, I think we need to, at least, the danger is to spiritualize away everything so that you don't see God present in the physical, everyday things of life, like weather and all our physical things.
Do you think we need to have maybe the possibility of a miracle sometimes just to keep hope alive. I think sometimes they say hope is very important for people that are, you know, critically ill and so on. And when a person has faith, even though it may not be answered that your miracle is happening, the fact that that hope exists is very important to someone who has a need for a miracle. And it keeps us, you know, keeps us spiritually alive as well.
Yeah, I think in a liberation perspective, that's probably been one of the most important things that's happened for me, coming to sort of have more faith in miracles, is seeing how they speak to people who are powerless in the world, who have no hope kind of in the structures of things as they are. For example, in Mexico, the whole piety that surrounds the Virgin of Guadalupe, it's poor people, it's the lowest class of people that you know, flock to the shrine, seeing there a power for liberation from oppression that is very, very important. And in the history sort of miracles, it has so often been poor and oppressed people who have cherished these stories of God coming to the powerless with power. And that does give hope. I think you can really read these stories with a liberation kind of perspective. Maybe not this one so much, but that it's the powers of Jesus confronting the oppressive powers of the old age. I guess you can hear, if you view the storm as another demon that oppresses us, and that Jesus comes to free us from that and give a sense of hope to those who are hopeless. Yeah.
I think we experienced a miracle about 4 years ago. We were here in Holden in July, and then that's before Christmas that year. Ed and I were involved in the terrible car accident. And we were rear-ended, as well as spun our car around, and somebody else really spun into us. But we were wearing our seatbelts. Anyway, it ended up so that our car, there were two people there to take us out before anything happened. And we were rescued. I ended up with 9 broken ribs, and everybody said, oh, you know, you feel those ribs for at least 2 years. Anyway, about 2 months after, I woke up one morning and I had no more pain. And Ed too was spared and extra pain and stuff. I know that God is with us and that God was praying for us. So, we're glad to be here today. In fact, this is our second trip to Poland
after the accident.
We've driven both times.
So. Wow. From far away, right? You're Canadian?
Canadian.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks.
When you talk about where is your place, and I think sometimes when we have prayed and the answer is not what we had hoped. Our expectations aren't even there, but we tend then to flog ourselves.
Yeah. I don't have enough faith. That's what's the problem.
Yeah, it's because of my little faith. As Cindy was saying, you know, then you wonder why there isn't the same kind of response, and you long for the kind of manifestation that there was once there. Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that?
All that, I'm just throwing it out. Mm-hmm. I think we tend to, because of our relationship, somehow
then internalize and feel guilty. Or we at times are made to feel guilty. It's laid upon us. Well, if you had more faith, you wouldn't be in this situation. And there are times I don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. And is Jesus imposing that question out? Yeah, that's a tough one. Cynthia, do you have your hand up, or are you just pulling your yarn out?
I'm just pulling my yarn.
Well, do you want to say anything?
Well, I should say something.
Okay, go ahead, say something.
When you asked her how she dealt with it, one of the ways that I've dealt with it is in a way that I deal with my marriage. After 13 years of marriage, and I'm sure many people in this room have been married longer, you come to realize that there are seasons of love in a marriage, that there are times when you feel very much in love, and there are times when you can look at your spouse and really not feel any affection at all. When you hit those kinds of times in your marriage, it's really important to treat that person, to keep the discipline of marriage, to treat that person with love and respect, and to rely on the commitment that you've made. And eventually, at some point in time, there is a renewal of the love that you have. But if at those moments, the winter times of your marriage, you would turn away and not keep the discipline and the commitments that you've made, then it will never come back. And that's how I continue when God's presence isn't that near to me, or when you yearn for a miracle, I then fall back on the discipline of prayer and of reading, and of putting myself in a place where I can hear God's word and God can talk to me in other ways. Because if I would absent myself from that discipline, then probably I'd get further away from being able to hear God's word in my life. This is from a person who isn't very disciplined.
No, but that's all the more inspiring for that reason.
Oh, I think that's a really helpful kind of description, and the discipline is the hardest to maintain.
What about the question of, one person proposed the first session that I thought was pretty helpful, that we might box God in a lot if we say that sort of there is a natural order of the way, you know, and we do have science now, so we know how the world works. Some things that, you know, that seemed miraculous formerly, like eclipses and stuff that seemed like portents of divine, we now realize, we know how eclipses work, so we've got that covered. So eclipses are no longer miraculous. And, you know, we now know how flowers are made, and it's scientific, so that's no longer miraculous, you know. So we've got sort of the scientific world, and then we only would name it as a miracle when it's something that defies nature. And someone was proposing at the first session that maybe what we need to do is start seeing the miraculous more in the everyday. Or is that a cop-out? I mean, because clearly the gospel writers viewed miracles as extraordinary. Like you say, Cindy, if they happened every day, they wouldn't be miracles anymore. So what do you think about that whole question? Are there everyday miracles? Or does that somehow diminish the weird miracles? Are eclipses miracles even though we've got them figured out? You know,
the whole creation is a miracle.
We take a lot of the wonderment out of life if we don't consider the sunrise in the morning. I like to run in the morning before the sunrise and the sun coming up. Sometimes the moon is still out. And those are miracles. Those are wonderful miracles. And so many things we just take the wonderment out of life if we don't consider the miracles.
I think every breath is a miracle. The creation of our bodies is just and miracle beyond our understanding. When we look at our bodies and how wonderfully they're made, we've got to be in wonderment, don't we? And then every breath we take, it's a miracle of life.
I must admit, like when you think of Jesus putting his body over this child three times, you know.
Elijah.
It strikes me as being, you know, a resuscitation or something, possibility. You know, I mean, we realize there are so many things like that. I think that's maybe what you meant, things that kind of could be explained a little bit today that have happened. But I also understand what they're saying, that, you know, every little mustard seed is just amazing, that it can be in the ground for 30 years and then suddenly burst forth. That's just amazing to me, in a way. So I do think there are miracles around this whole thing.
Or the fact that you were, you know, you can explain that you were pulled from the car, somebody pulled you out, and so physically you know what happened, and yet you are interpreting that as a miracle, and so...
They were right there when they were needed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
There was even a nurse passing by on the highway. She came raining down to see if she could help them.
Huh. Yeah.
So I know the Lord is looking after us.
Yeah.
Because we should have been wiped out. We could have been wiped out with us.
I think anyone who's been a parent thinks of child growth very often takes child development for granted, normal, so to speak, normal child development. Then I think if you were to ask Paul Bowe what it would be to have a healthy, normal child, the rest of us then would quickly look at the life of a child as a miracle.
I thought you were going to say it's a miracle that they reach adulthood. Because there are so many close calls, you know, when you think of children. I mean,
I think it's a miracle that they're born healthy.
Yeah, that's right. It's
but they're born healthy.
No, they're falling.
Yeah. All that. When you think of all the things that could go wrong, even.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be out medically.
And all of that is.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is a college of 45,000 students, at one of the churches I work at, there are 150 faculty members who belong. When I came there, I expected that the faculty members would be mostly in liberal arts, philosophy, and education.
They're scientists, aren't they?
All of them, except for one. So science explaining a lot of things doesn't explain away faith, you know, I think these people tend to think the more they learn, the more they see the hand of the Creator, you know, but which isn't to say that all the scientists at the university are Christians. That's not true either. But the knowledge that they have gained through their research, instead of explaining away all the mysteries, has only led them into deeper and deeper mysteries.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. And that, in fact, a lot of science, I mean, Einstein would be a great example of this. I mean, sort of the most brilliant science now, at least since the 1920s, and I can't remember it very well. I used to be a science major, and it's faded quickly, but the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, I mean, sort of where science has almost now found out for a fact that uncertainty is the bottom line in the atom. I mean, that you cannot predict what orbit the electrons are going to be in, and at so many levels that they go to the very deepest tiny particle and find mystery. You know, that is sort of the principle of the universe. Now that science, you know, you can read about it in articles that mystery or unpredictability is the bottom line in some kind of exciting ways. You know, maybe sort of paradoxically making room for faith again, where the scientists of the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries thought that science excluded faith. Now we are in post-Einsteinian physics, and there's a real different way of looking at the world from the 18th century, where maybe many of us lay people, non-scientists, are still stuck in that kind of understanding border. Yeah, thanks. What was I going to ask? I had another question.
I wonder if miracles aren't often given us when we really need them. You know, shall I say extraordinary miracles then? Because I just finished saying every day is a miracle. You know, life is, but extraordinary, as there's a real need in our life.
Well, I can witness to that.
Yeah, and some people need more than others to, you know, but like take Ed and Eileen's situation, there was a definite need for a miracle there, and so God provided it. For in order for them to live, there had to be miracles taking place, and God was there to give it. I tend to believe that.
I think for me, one of the most important things, going back to school, I have to confess how much I didn't read while I was out of school, but which makes me realize again what an undisciplined person I am, but was finding out sort of about how many other people in antiquity were doing miracles. I had never realized sort of how widespread it was, and I guess in a sense for me that was a relief, because it meant that miracles weren't sort of what per se made Jesus unique, so that wasn't kind of the bottom line of Christianity, which I think sometimes, not Billy Graham, but so many people in religion these days try to tell you, you know, expect a miracle, and then somehow if you don't, that means you don't have faith. But I guess realizing that Jesus' uniqueness is something other than doing miracles. I mean, because so many other people were doing miracles. Dionysus was doing resurrection miracles. Serapis, at least, you know, people understood all these other people to be doing miracles. But what the other people weren't doing was being suffering servants. You know, it takes you right back to the cross, that's the one unique feature of Christianity is that servanthood, discipleship, and love of enemies that you don't find in any other Greco-Roman religion of the time. Jesus was utterly unique in preaching love of enemies and in calling people to be servants and in himself being a servant. So that was a real eye-opener for me. And not to diminish miracles, it's obviously really important that the gospel writers tell the story of Jesus in terms of miracles, in terms of day-to-day involvement in our physical life. And wanting to overcome the powers of death, which in this case was the storm. I had one other question. What is it? That was a good question, too.
Well, I guess I'm here today because of a miracle. After the accident, the police told us it was only a miracle that we were out of that car. He keeps the word miracle. When he looked at the car, he said, nobody should be alive.
Huh. That's great. And we heard Erling's story this week too, you know, a miraculous healing there. It's really neat to know that God is still working that way.
I know it certainly helped my faith after the accident, because I suddenly saw life as being something very, very precious. We tend to take things for granted when everything's going on fine. And just to know that the Lord is with us and he gave us more life. It's a great thing to appreciate.
Do any of you ever pray prayers like we saw with the psalmist, wake up, O God? I mean, what is Jesus ever asleep like he was in the boat with those disciples? Does he need to be woken up? Is that still important, or does that indicate doubt that you seem to have to wake Jesus up like the disciples did? Or what do you think on that? Do you pray the psalms? Those ones.
Indicates impatience.
And in a negative way, or?
Impatience on our part. You know, wake up, God. Why aren't you doing something now? For me, it does, anyway, when I start doing that.
I think the Jewish people often speak to God, and of course, God, they feel their God
and they are God's chosen people. But I've heard them say, you know, speaking very loudly, God, wake up. We're suffering. We're, you know, during these really terrible times that they went through, they spoke directly to God like that. They still do that. I've heard rabbis say how they feel they can speak to God directly and say, you know, what's going on here, sort of, like, you know, and so I don't know if we do that, but I think they, I know they do.
And I think that we need to start doing that more, praying those psalms in, a, I guess, in, you know, taking God on kind of as a friend, as someone that you, you know, it's, I have to sometimes shake up, you know, like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, just talk to God and sort of challenge God and all those. I think the psalms really invite us to do that. I know the question I was going to ask, is salvation equivalent to physical survival? As I think the disciples are saying it is in this case. They wake up Jesus and say, save, Lord, for we are perishing. In other words, if they had died in that storm, would that have been perishing? Or how do you know how much stock to put in the sort of physical survival angle of things? Or is Jesus saying, where is your faith? Because they should have believed that even if they had died in that boat, he was with them. And that's what important. What's important? That sort of question about salvation and our physical bodies and life and all those kinds of things. What do you think on that?
I think when they said we are perishing, they meant their physical body right now. I don't think they were worried about their salvation.
Uh-huh.
I think they were worried about their physical body. No.
And what do you think Luke wants us to worry about, or Jesus in this passage? It is that level, isn't it? Or not?
I don't pretend to, you know, put words or thoughts into Jesus' mouth. He very well may have meant both. I mean, presumably he had the bigger picture in mind, but how much he expected the people to have, I don't know.
Do I understand you to be asking, in simplified terms, is death, physical death, always evil?
Yeah, that's probably the bottom line. Or in these, yeah, in a story like this that points us so much back to the physical level of saying, yeah, that seems to indicate that it is, that in that, that physical death would have been evil for those disciples. What do you think on that?
Well,
or are miracles always going to save us from death, kind of? Uh-huh.
I mean, I think death is always evil. I mean, if one of my children had died, I wouldn't have looked upon that as a happy instance or even what God would have wanted. And I think death is always an evil experience. That doesn't mean that there isn't more. And that I couldn't give over my child to the resurrection and to live with God. But there's very few people that I know who welcome death. I mean, maybe if you're 96 and have lived a full life and you're tired and you're ready to go home, then it becomes more part of the natural order, but this certainly wasn't part of the natural order. And in Jewish tradition at this time, I mean, I don't know that there was a clear definition of resurrection yet, was there? And so for these folks, maybe Sheol was it.
Yeah.
The place of the dead. So the power of resurrection had to be demonstrated to them.
And the story gave Luke an opportunity to see how powerful God is in this world and the next, in a way. I mean, the sisters, you know, so quickly, in just a sentence, it gives you an idea of how powerful, how much authority and all that sort of thing. The setting, and then the, you know, in just a short few lines, gives us an awful lot to picture the power of God, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think Luke is almost, but Mark does this too, these nature miracles almost sort of reveal Jesus as more powerful than the healings did in a way. I don't know, see what you think about that, but this is the first time sort of where the disciples really marvel and say, who is this then that he commands even the wind and the waves? They've seen him heal people, you know, but now he's commanding even the wind and the waves, and that's somehow even more powerful. It's an interesting sort of thing there. And I think, yeah, what we're supposed to see in this is the identity of Jesus as God, frankly, because that's who stills the storm and controls the waves. But it's interesting that that's even more powerful. Well,
May I just go back to that last question you asked? I have trouble with that, you know, about saying, wake up, God, you know, and certainly we see things like that in the psalmist. But I think that's contrary to the word of God. We know God is never asleep. Like you quoted from Psalm 131, he neither slumbers nor sleeps. And the Bible constantly tells us that he is everywhere present, he is with us. So I think if we're saying that, we're not taking the word of God.
But why do you give priority to 121 over 44, for example, where God does need to be woken up?
Well, I suppose that was disbelief. I know throughout the Psalms you find where the psalmist is having a great deal of trouble. He feels left and so on. You know.
And does that all indicate disbelief?
I kind of have always thought that it shows a lot of human weakness, but then usually he ends up, the psalmist usually end up by saying, well, you know, where they come, they have all these doubts, and then they come and have the answer where they knew God is there. But throughout the New Testament, if we're going to take that, we're not given that, are we? There's so many promises.
Yeah. No, you're right. There is a sense in which the disciples are their faith is in question when they have to wake Jesus up and answer.
I would have trouble with that because instead of me praying and, you know, saying, God, where are you? And wake up, will you come and help me? I always feel that, like I pray, God, thank you. You are here, even if I can't see you.
And maybe we're the ones who need to wake up.
Yes,
who needs to wake up?
Yeah, not God.
Is it the disciples or Jesus who are asleep?
God's always awake.
Well, hopefully we haven't solved all the problems of the world here, and there's a little bit more to do in a couple more sessions.